This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we mourn the passing of Fidel Castro.
Although vilified in the U.S. media for decade after decade after decade, and now finally at his death, we believe that Fidel Castro was one of the great people of the 20th century and perhaps of all centuries.
Attorney Jeff Haas brings us another dispatch from the protest encampment at Standing Rock.
Despite the horrific winter and the threats of the governor, the water protectors are holding on. Let's hear what Jeff has to say.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Heidi, both of us have been supporters of the Cuban Revolution. Both of us have heard Fidel Castro speak personally. I know you did in New York. I think you were at the same meeting I was 20-some years ago. What was your impression?
Michael, I actually wasn't there 20 years ago, but I did hear Fidel speak in person in 2000 in Havana at the International Association of Democratic Lawyers Congress there. He spoke for a couple of hours, welcoming us, talking about the importance of the work the Congress was doing. And Fidel has been an inspiration to me for years. I was lucky at the National Lawyers Guild to travel to Cuba four times, once as a guest of the Cuban government, and really saw the many different aspects of socialism at work in their community, from the free medical school to the organic gardens, an inspiration forever.
Yeah, I was up in Harlem in 1995 in October when Fidel returned to Harlem. You know, he had been there in 1960,
yes.
And he was kicked out of Midtown, and he took refuge in the Hotel Teresa, the famous hotel on 125th Street in Harlem. That's where Malcolm X had his office, and Fidel admired Malcolm X very much, and vice versa. So 35 years later, Fidel came back to New York and again found himself in Harlem. He got a tremendous welcome. He was at the historic Abyssinian Baptist Church, which had been organized in support of the Black liberation struggle all the way back in the 1850s. And at that time, Reverend Calvin Butts was the reverend. Adam Clayton Powell had come from that church years earlier. And Reverend Butts introduced Fidel, and he said, I remember the first time I met Fidel was at a liberation theology conference in Havana. I said, do you believe in God? He said, and Fidel answered, he said, well, if I did, it would be a God of justice, peace, and equality. And then he introduced Fidel, and Fidel took the podium, and there was an ovation. I thought the roof was going to fall off. I'm not exaggerating. It was thunderous for 10 minutes. And Fidel, when things finally quieted down, and I took notes of this, and what Fidel said was, as a revolutionary, I knew I would be welcome in this neighborhood. You are the best representatives of the virtue of the American people.
I just wanted to note, because we have a really wonderful interview with Jim Cockcroft about Fidel and what he's contributed. But one thing we didn't mention is the amount that the Cuban government spends on education. It's about 13% of their total national budget, more than any other country. They have just about 100% literacy rate, which I think speaks so much to the values of that country, along with a lower infant mortality rate than our country, and several other advances, including in medicine. They have a treatment now for lung cancer that the U.S. is going to be trying. And so often people don't talk about the advances they've made in spite of the U.S. embargo against this nation for 55 years.
And there was a point when the Cubans could not even import an aspirin.
Their creativity and perseverance and commitment to the values of socialism.
I wanted to end up on a quote from Fidel on the values. He said the Spaniards came to Cuba with a cross and a sword. He said that plots are being hatched today to murder leaders of our country, including Fidel, over 600
Many
plots.
Many times.
And he says, and that hasn't changed. And Fidel concluded by telling the story of a South American native who was being tortured by the Spaniards. They were burning the native and told the poor fella that in the end he would go to heaven. To this, the nearly dead man replied, "I do not want to go to heaven if there are Spaniards there." Fidel concluded saying he wanted to have a heaven here on earth, a place we can easily get to, a place where there is justice, brotherhood, and dignity. And for that cause, I'm willing to give up my life. When the American-supported military dictator of Cuba, Fulgencio Batista, fled Cuba in January of 1959, and the revolutionary government led by Fidel Castro marched into Havana, they passed three laws. The first lowered the age so that Fidel could become prime minister. He was 33 years old. The second made Che Guevara a citizen of Cuba. He was an Argentinian. And the third was the Great Agrarian Reform Law. It took land from the large plantations, owned mostly by American corporations, and distributed it to the people who worked it. The Cuban government had a right to do this under international law. They offered compensation. The Cuban government said they would reimburse the mostly American corporate landowners the amount that they had listed as the value of the land for tax purposes. The corporations would not agree. Instead, the American-owned oil refinery refused to refine oil. This would have shut down the Cuban economy. The Cubans responded by nationalizing the oil refinery. Then they nationalized the telephone company, the nickel mines, the automobile assembly plant, and so on. The Cuban state took control over their own economy. This became what is known as the historic Cuban Socialist Revolution. United States policy, from that day till now, has been to overthrow this revolution and reinstall capitalism. For 47 years, Fidel Castro led the Cuban government in its resistance to American counter-revolutionary activity. We speak today with retired Professor James Cockcroft. Cockcroft has been a lifelong supporter of the Cuban Revolution. He has written over 50 books, several on Latin America and on Cuba, including most recently, Cuba in My Blood. He has traveled to Cuba many, many times, has been active in Cuba solidarity work, and has called Fidel Castro a personal friend. Jim Cockcroft, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
The Cuban mission here in New York to the United Nations is open for people to write in the Castro Memorial Book, and our friend Joel Covell plans to write the following. Fidel Castro was the greatest human being with whom I've shared my 80 years on the planet. Jim, you've also been on this planet for 80 years. What would you write in this memorial book? That is, what is your evaluation of Fidel Castro in the Cuban Revolution?
It would be the same as Joel's. And I would comment, though, that the Cuban Revolution and Fidel Castro's role in it has made unique accomplishments, in part because of his unique leadership. It has been, from the beginning, a revolution of the humble, for the humble, and by the humble. Or another translation would be, of the humiliated, for the humiliated, and by the humiliated, to quote Fidel. I would also say, just not necessarily in the guest book, because we have a guest book here in Montreal also from where I'm speaking, and I'll be assigning that this week. But I will comment to the listeners that death is not true when one has accomplished well one's life's work. That's a quotation from Jose Marti. And another quotation from a friend of mine, which I think is even more appropriate, is, Fidel has not died. He doesn't die because we keep him alive. It's a way of summarizing how there has been a tremendous interchange from the beginning. With the humiliated, again, with the peasants in the Sierra Maestra and so on of the Cuban Revolution that Fidel Castro has cultivated. And it It means that all the reforms that he has introduced, all the unique accomplishments of the Cuban Revolution and their people, in all senses. I mean, it's even recognized as the most ecologically advanced country in the world by the WF, World Federation of Ecology. I forget the name of the group. And but that's just one of many accomplishments, which we can talk about later. But for now, I think that would be my answer to your first question.
Jim, there's been a torrential downpour of negative press that we've experienced here in New York. And it's ironic because I know, and you and Heidi know something about the way the Cuban government runs and what Fidel was all about. Ralph Nader has called the United States of America a one-party state, a big business party with two right wings. In Cuba, there are governments at the municipal, regional, and federal level. How does their government run? Did the Castro government really murder dissidents and massively imprison people? Is it a dictatorship? That's what we've been getting from the press. Please explain what really goes on in Cuba.
Well, what we've been getting from the press, which is not just in the United States, where the media is controlled by six large corporations, but internationally, the same media affect propaganda against Cuba, except in the cases of independent media or a few other countries who have a different slant on Cuba. So this demonization of Cuba is part of the history of U.S. oppression of the Cuban people, going back to the founding fathers of the American Constitution, who always viewed Cuba as a fruit ripe for falling in the basket of the United States. And of course, the corporations and so on, banks and so on, did create a neo-colony in Cuba when the United States invaded Cuba at the very end of the successful War of Liberation for Independence in late 1890s, and created a neo-colony in Cuba, stealing the freedom of Cuba that the slaves and other activist revolutionaries led by Jose Marti and others had created independence from Spain. So the governing question is the fact that Cuba's democracy is different than the U.S. democracy. First of all, the United States doesn't really have a democracy, but that's another topic. It pretends to have a democracy, but even the popular opinion polls leading up to the last presidential elections in the United States revealed a majority of the American people, a large majority, feeling that there was no democracy, that the system was rigged. And in Cuba, the system's not rigged because, first of all, there are no millionaires to control the whole situation. Second of all, no campaign funding whatsoever is allowed in all the different campaigns that occur every year, with national elections every 5 years, but elections going on all the time at the local, provincial, and federal level in Cuba, in which people discuss and select candidates that they themselves nominate, including the members of the Communist Party, which is the sort of overarching democratic structure that governs decision-making in Cuba through the People's Assembly. So if you look at that sort of grassroots democracy that's evolved since 1959, you have simply a different way of approaching democracy. It's a socialist way, a participatory way, with all kinds of limitations, undoubtedly, but much more democratic than most other countries in the world.
Jim, even critics of Cuba have had to concede that that nation has a wonderful medical system, free education through college, a nearly 100% literacy rate, and guaranteed housing for their population. How does this compare to other impoverished third world countries? And do you think that it's possible to make these achievements with the capitalist mode of production?
Well, in terms of the second question, capitalist mode of production possibilities, no, it's just not possible. Just look at the big pharmas, for example, in the United States, are all the privatization that's been going on for 35 years, not only in the United States, but in many other countries of the world, and certainly in Europe. The privatization of everything, including life itself, under neoliberalism. It's a capitalist mode of production that's sort of a cowboy capitalism without any limits from the people at all. The second part of your question is no, it's simply not possible under the capitalist mode of production because the driving force in capitalist societies is the profit motive. As we all know, profits become concentrated in less than 1% of the population. In the case of the United States, it's actually 0.1% that are the super rich that the Occupy movement brought to light, making it legitimate to talk about this now in the United States, whatever failures the Occupy movement may have had or repression it may have suffered.
Jim, what has the Cuban government done to eradicate centuries of racial oppression against the Afro-Cuban population there?
Well, it's done a lot, Heidi, a lot. And I would just point out that the elimination of racism has been a struggle of the Cuban people, both black and mestizo, and even some whites like Jose Marti, from the get-go. It was the Cuban slaves who liberated themselves in the 30 Years' War of the 19th century and then fought in the Wars of Independence of the 1890s and created tremendous successes militarily, the freed slaves did, in Cuba against Spain before the United States stepped in, invaded, and stole the whole thing from the Cuban people. Then the United States imposed racism, as we all know, typical racism of the time, in the 20th century. And Castro came into power in 59, and the people rose up to support him and to make his victory possible, and proceeded to introduce all these create a new constitution that eliminated racism. Now, carrying out the elimination of racism is always a complex process, and there still are a few signs of remaining racism in Cuba, but nothing to compare with all the racism that went before. And so in that sense, it has eradicated centuries of racial oppression against the Afro-Cuban population.
Jim, speaking of Africa, when Nelson Mandela finally got out of prison, the first place he visited was Cuba and embraced Fidel literally. And I wanted to ask you what your reaction to that was at the time and in retrospect.
Well, very positive. The end of apartheid actually was made possible by the thousands of Cuban troops in Angola fighting the invasion of Angola from Namibia and South Africa by the apartheid regime. And in the Battle of Cuito Cuanavale in Angola in 1987, the final blow was dealt to that South African invasion. And Angola became free shortly thereafter, as did Namibia, by the way. And, of course, apartheid ended after that, because what happened in 87 was that victory, and the Cubans, in a sense, understood that to defend themselves, they also have to defend other peoples who were facing the same oppression. So I think the final note I'd make on Angola and South Africa for you is that in a recording by one of the major networks in the United States that was broadcast only once on television and then deleted and never repeated again, a microphone was open when Mandela embraced Fidel after the end of apartheid in South Africa, this was. And Mandela said to Fidel, "You and the Cuban people made this possible." So it was actually heard on the mic during a newscast and then, of course, deleted in all future newscasts.
Jim, what did Fidel do in the Cuban government with respect to improving conditions of life in Latin American countries?
A lot, especially its sending of internationalist volunteers without pay in everything from education to medicine to sports to recreation throughout the world, but especially in Latin America, this had a tremendous impact. The other thing that had such an impact was the creation of CELAC and the integration of Latin America. CELAC is the assembly, forget the name in Spanish and English, I have trouble translating back and forth, but in any case, the Confederation of Latin American States and countries, which brought together even the right-wing governments of Latin America in the 21st century. This was the final step of the Cuban government's push for integration of Latin America and the Caribbean. And it still exists, this integration. And of course, Chavez gave it impetus also, by the way, in Venezuela. And this led also to improving conditions of life in Latin American countries. But most of all, I think, is the inspirational example of the Cuban Revolution. That's why so many Latin American presidents, even the right-wing ones, really honor Cuba and respect Fidel Castro. Yesterday, today, and this weekend at the funeral in Santiago de Cuba.
Milton, the poet, has written, "Childhood shows the man as morning shows the day." Fidel Castro grew up on an extremely rural farm in central Cuba. His father was an immigrant from Galicia, Spain, and his mother had been the cook on the farm. As a child, Castro played as equals with the other children whose parents worked on the farm. He later was sent off to a Jesuit school and trained by the Jesuits, and he was quickly recognized as an outstanding athlete and an outstanding orator, and was recognized finally as he completed high school as the greatest student of his generation. You've met him several times and talked with him at length. What were your impressions of him when you met him?
Well, let me just say that growing up, I went to that farm where he grew up, okay? What you said about him and the farm and his early life is true, and that the Jesuits who trained him, the leading Jesuit at the school he went to in Santiago de Cuba, starting at age 6, 7, or 8, as I recall, that particular priest went into exile in 1961 and said he had never had such a great student as Fidel, and that he can't get over how brilliant Fidel is and how many good things Fidel is doing, has done for Cuba. This he said after having gone into exile. So it's very interesting that everyone, even those who went into exile, had a certain attraction for Fidel and his way of speaking and relating to other human beings. Now, in my own personal case, I had a chance to meet with him in February 2007. He invited me to meet with him. For 5 hours we talked, a private conversation. I asked that the translator not bother since I'm fluent in Spanish. And so we had quite an intense and lively discussion, full of questions, dialogue, lessons learned, proposals, original ideas to pursue and investigate, Fidel being the motor power of that part of the discussion. The other thing was he didn't talk much. He had questions for me. He's always questioning the people he meets with, and he listens. He's a great listener. And the other thing that struck me was his sense of humor, sometimes very self-derogatory. His sense of humor has never been known by the public, unlike his brother's sense of humor, which everyone knows about. Other experiences I've had by reading his speeches since the days in the Sierra Maestra with Radio Rebelde in the 50s is that Fidel has always been a prophet with a heart and brain endlessly expanding. In 1992, he said there at the Rio Conference on Climate and Environment, he said there is a species in danger of extinction, 1992, and that species is the human being. So he's always had this sort of visionary understanding of what the future might hold. And he's always been self-critical. He criticized himself for the bad policies on homosexuals in the 70s, saying he was so busy with other things he let it go, but he realizes he was totally wrong. And now, of course, the daughter of Raul Castro is pushing reforms that will make Cuba the most progressive country in the world on the rights of gays, lesbians, and bigender people, and so on. It's a process, though, and it has to be voted on and consulted on at every level of society, like they did with the new guidelines, and are still doing, by the way. And always with high moral standards and a sense of internationalism and honest humility. That's the practice of Fidel. And pluralism. He recognizes that peoples must make their revolutions tuned to their own cultures and circumstances. So he doesn't see Cuba as a universal formula or an absolute model, but as a revolutionary praxis, a process of learning as we go along, incorporating struggles for peace, social justice, gender and ethnic equality, respect for diverse sexual preferences, all human rights, and the defense of Pachamama, Mother Earth. So this is the Fidel that I've gotten to know over the decades and had the chance to see up close personally in 2007 before he began to undergo some health problems later that year. So that is my take on Fidel, and I think it's the same take that many people have had with him. Ignacio Ramonet, the famous journalist from France who wrote that beautiful volume on interviewing Fidel and his life. I recommend it to your listeners.
I read it and recommend it also. It's an excellent book.
Yeah.
The press here has been emphasizing dictatorship of Fidel Castro and his crushing of dissidents, assassinating them, imprisoning them by the mass. It's just really, really been overwhelming. And this is not true. I know something about this, and I know you do too. And I wanted to ask you, what is the position of the government with respect to dissidents? Are there prisons full of political prisoners, like
no.
Trump claims?
No. Look, what few political prisoners there have been convicted of crimes in the judicial system. They have people's courts down there. It's not the Supreme Court of the United States style. It's people's courts. And all the dissidents are so-called, by the way, because many of them are frankly, lackeys of Washington. They receive all kinds of money from the government in Washington. And any money received by a Cuban in Cuba is a fortune if it's coming from Washington compared to the average income of Cubans in a poor Caribbean island. So these so-called dissidents, some of them were, by the way, convicted of crimes and imprisoned, and almost all of them had been released. I don't know if there are more than a handful left. I know the government just recently, very recently, released another 83. So, but the main point is that there's a chance for these people to be released, even though they've been convicted. Unlike the United States, where we have people like the leadership in the American Indian movement serving long sentences, and we're hoping that Obama might pardon some of them, or Oscar Lopez, the nonviolent patriot of Puerto Rico, defender of Puerto Rican independence, that we have an international campaign to free from prison in the United States, or the Cuban Five, the five Cuban heroes who were actually placed in the hole and basically tortured, as were their families, all those years until they were released thanks to the campaigns in Cuba and outside of Cuba, the international campaign in which you and I participated on December 17, 2014, when diplomatic relations were renewed between the United States and Cuba. So this is another big lie about Cuba, that he's some kind of dictator murdering dissidents and mass incarcerations and so on. It's absolutely a big lie, and the American public will never know about it until they're allowed to know about it through radio programs like yours.
Absolutely, Jim. No, Heidi and I were very active in the defense of the Cuban Five. In fact, when Heidi was the head of the Lawyers Guild, she put out a small book on it.
I just want to say that Michael Ratner and Lenny Wineglass, two of the many lawyers, such as yourself, who fought for the Cuban Five and are now deceased, are very much with us at times like this, just as Fidel is at times like this.
Yeah.
And we really must honor all the solidarity work that lawyers like you, Lenny, and Michael Ratner have been doing all these years.
Yeah, well, Heidi and I welcome your saying that because they've been on our minds. In 1953, Castro led an attack on the military fortress called Moncado in the eastern part of Cuba. It was the second biggest fortress in the country. And he did it in an attempt to overthrow the military dictatorship of Batista, who was supported by the United States. It failed. He was captured and sent to prison and then amnestied and went to Mexico, where he regrouped. He sailed on the motor yacht Granma from Mexico to Cuba with 82 men in 1956. They were attacked by the Batista forces. Only 12 survived. They went into the Sierra Maestra Mountains, and with the support of a large urban revolutionary movement, they were able to overthrow the American-backed military dictatorship of Batista within 3 years. Would you agree that this is one of the most extraordinary achievements in the 20th century?
Yes, I would agree with that. By the way, it wasn't just the urban revolutionary movement underground. It was the rural revolutionary movement as well. I was in Cuba just a few weeks after the landing of the Granma and the and Fidel and Che and so on, and after only 12 survived that landing, bombed, by the way, by U.S. planes provided Batista. I witnessed, without knowing Spanish, in my two-week vacation in Cuba, in the eastern province of Oriente, where Santiago de Cuba is and where Fidel will be buried this weekend, I witnessed all the photographs in the newspapers, since I didn't know Spanish, I had to rely on photographs, of the mutilated bodies of violated and assassinated young men and women. In fact, I was arrested twice during that so-called vacation and beaten on the second occasion by Batista soldiers just outside of Santiago. Sort of helped make me a revolutionary. And I realized my only crime was being young. And I always tell that story to the Cuban people when I'm down there being interviewed on radio or television so that their current generation of young people will know just what it had been under Batista. It's so different ever since 1959.
Jim, in our remaining few minutes, what is Fidel Castro's legacy?
That's an impossible question to answer, but I will, and many people have answered it in various ways, but I will say this, that he was very much influenced by the father of Cuban independence, Jose Martí, who died in battle against the Spaniards at age 42, and whose complete works are over 70 volumes being revised in a critical edition even as we speak. A real genius, in other words, poet, soldier, leader, unifier, internationalist, made the Revolutionary Party include Puerto Ricans and not just Cubans. So this Martí influence on Fidel is part of his legacy, because in a sense, Martí was always influencing the Cuban people at the base, because they knew his poetry and they knew who he was. And Fidel extended that for decades during the Cuban Revolution that continues today. The other aspect besides the Martí culture is culture in general, or what we call Cubanidad, Cubanness. The new value system that the revolution has introduced, one that treasures respecting and loving the other, helping one another out, being not just nationalist and patriotic for the homeland, but internationalist, helping others all around the world. This new value system, this tremendous revolutionary culture is really significant factor in Fidel's legacy. And it, of course, isn't a perfect culture in Cuba. Let me remark that, like any other country, there's some corruption there, but nothing on the scale of the Western capitalist countries, nothing compared to those. And moreover, the Cubans, unlike the West, criticize themselves for their corruption, be it Fidel himself criticizing it when he was president, or Raul now that he's president, and so on. And certainly the Cuban people, they're all, it's a small island, it's like a village. It's a small island, 11 million people. Everyone knows what's going on. But the value system, the Cubanidad, is what's so important. I think that is going to be a lasting part of Fidel's legacy. There will be constitutional changes, but they'll never have capitalism in Cuba. The Cuban people have a new value system now. They don't respect the profit motive and corruption in the United States and other countries, and certainly not the violence. Fidel's final words in all his latest testaments of the last 10 years were always about peace. The most important task of humanity today is peace.
Jim Cockcroft, it's truly been a pleasure to hear your thoughts on Fidel Castro. We look forward to educating those critics through this show over the next weeks to come.
Thank you so much, Jim. Appreciate being able to talk to you.
Thank you, Heidi and Michael, and keep up the good work, because we do have to break the distortions and the news blackout we're getting on the real Cuba.
Thanks, Jim. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Yo soy un hombre sincero, de donde crece la palma. Yo soy un hombre sincero, de donde crece la palma. Antes de morir me quiero, echa mis versos del alma. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Mi verso es de un verde claro.
We next speak with Ike Nahum, the head of Cuba Solidarity New York. Ike Nahum is a longtime anti-war, socialist, and labor activist. He's the coordinator of Cuba Solidarity and a founder of the July 26th Coalition. Nahum is an Amtrak locomotive engineer and a member of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. Ike Nahum, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Ike, you are the coordinator of Cuba Solidarity here in New York, and all of us have been reading the horrific corporate media coverage on Cuba and Fidel, and then listening to Trump and his threats against Cuba. What do you folks have planned in terms of defense of Cuba?
If Trump seriously is going to try to revive and go back to the Clinton and Bush II policies of overt belligerence and so on, and confrontation and to try to go back to that period in today's world, well, you know, good luck to him on that. That will be a huge political price that the United States government will pay in Latin America and around the world for that. So we will have to see. We will stay cool-headed, like I'm sure the people in Cuba will, and we have a number of activities. In the next period, we're going to organize a giant memorial celebration of Fidel's life that will be announced when we get a venue and the right time in this holiday season. Most significantly coming up at the Fordham Law School, March 25th and 26th of next year, there's going to be a national conference that had been called a while back and is now building very nicely, and I'm sure is going to get a boost from what Trump is saying. This will be one of the first, and it's a national conference on for the full normalization of relations between the United States and Cuba. This was called before Trump's election, but the bellicose signals that Trump is sending, I'm sure, will give a boost. This is going to be one of the first national gatherings, under the new Trump administration, and I'm sure it will attract fighters from all over the United States and Canada. That will be workshops and plenary sessions that will map out and bring together people to discuss, a broad group of people, how to fight for full normalization and to fight back against any new attempts by the United States government under Trump to revive the anti-Cuba policies, which have really never ended, of the past 60 years.
Well, thanks, Ike. Before we have to say goodbye to you, I wanted to ask you, does your group, Cuba Solidarity, have a website that people can contact and learn more about the Fordham meeting in March?
Sure. The name of the group that I head is called Cuba Solidarity New York, but it's part of a broader coalition that's building this national conference that's called the U.S.-Cuba Normalization Coalition, which unites many groups. There is a website of the July 26 coalition, which is july26coalition.org, which will have updated information on the national conference. We're in the process of constructing a Facebook and website page. People can get a hold of us by email at cubac@googlegroups.com, and or people can call me for more information. My number is 917-887-8710.
Ike Nahum, thank you very much. We wish you the best of luck on this organizing, and we'll be checking in with you. You take it easy.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Heidi, and have a great day.
At the time of our weekly dispatch from Standing Rock, North Dakota, at least two major developments were unfolding. Governor Jack Dalrymple had recently enacted an emergency evacuation order, citing public safety due to the frigid weather. And as many as 2,000 veterans are planning to gather there next week to serve as human shields for protesters who have, for months, clashed with the police over the pipeline construction. The evacuation order was issued to the hundreds of Dakota Access Pipeline protesters camping on U.S. Army Corps of Engineers land near the Missouri River. It was given as a winter storm left about half a foot of snow throughout the central part of the state. It followed an order by the Corps that the land was to have been closed to the public earlier last week. Law enforcement officials have said they would begin blocking supplies, including food, from entering the main protest camp. The order means that emergency services will not be made available to people at the camp except on a case-by-case basis, and the order will remain until the governor rescinds it. Standing Rock Tribal Chairman Dave Archambault II called the order, quote, a menacing action meant to cause fear and is a blatant attempt by the state and local officials to usurp and circumvent federal authority. The veterans' effort is planned as a nonviolent intervention to defend demonstrators from what the group calls, quote, assault and intimidation at the hands of the militarized police force. Joining us again is attorney Jeff Haas to give us a weekly dispatch. Jeff Haas, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, it's been a really busy period at Standing Rock. What is the status of the two evacuation orders?
Well, thousands of people have rallied up to the camp in the face of look like an imminent confrontation. And so what's happened is first the Army Corps of Engineers told the main camp, the Sacagawea camp, that they had to leave, that they would no longer provide services, including porta potties or emergency services, trash pickup, and that they had to be out by December 5th. Then they retracted that and said, well, and the tribe said, no, thank you, we're not going to move. They did offer them some other space. Then the governor came on and said, well, if you're not going to move them off, I'm going to enter an emergency order because of the weather, and for their own safety, we are going to order them to leave. We will have no supplies entering. If you leave, you can't come back. We're basically going to block the entrance, and it was pretty much a manifesto. And then in the face of that, the people there again said, we're not going to move, or we will move as soon as you stop the pipeline construction. We'll be happy to move. And so now the governor has backed off and said, well, he didn't really mean that. It's very cold up there right now. There is sort of a blizzard going on. So the conditions with the cold and the wind and the snow, and I think the idea of then trying to cut off food and fuel and wood for the camp that's digging in would have looked too bad. And I think they saw they had a confrontation on their hands in front of the whole world. So now the governor said he didn't really mean that. He's not going to use force right now to evict the people. So we sort of have a standoff, and then we have a number of veterans, supposedly in the thousands, who are going up there, not armed, but ready to protect the camp. And we're sort of in a limbo. So that's the situation literally right now. And how that's going to play out this weekend, we don't know. There were 140 felonies set for Monday, and those have mostly been dropped. So that's unclear on what's happening on those court cases. This is the one where everybody was charged because a fire was set in the middle of a protest, or not in the middle, on the edge, and everybody got charged with endangerment by fire, a conspiracy to commit endangerment by fire. So meanwhile, those are things that are happening, and then our group, the Water Protectors Legal Collective, Monday on the 29th, filed a lawsuit for the increasing militarization of the law response up there. And on the 20th of November, people from the camp attempted to move some vehicles which were blocking the bridge just north of the camp, which is the main road to Bismarck and for emergency services, and also the main road south to the Standing Rock Reservation. Anyway, there was a confrontation on the 20th in which people came on the bridge to try to clear it, and they were met by all kinds of armaments, really, starting with rubber bullets, starting with concussion grenades. CS canisters were shot and thrown at people. And then on a very cold night with the wind blowing, the law enforcement decided to use water cannons, which resulted in a lot of people getting hypothermia, drenched clothing. The people had really no place to escape to. So yesterday, we filed a lawsuit in the district court against the excessive use of force by law enforcement, and also the excessive use of force being used to deter First Amendment protest activities. So that lawsuit, we should get a hearing on the TRO very shortly. And I think it was publicized, and you may know one woman was hit in the arm by one of those concussion grenades, we think it was, and she's had part of her arm amputated and was fighting to hold on to the rest. And someone else was hit in the eye with a rubber bullet or some kind of projectile and has a detached retina. So these supposedly non-lethal armaments, when they're used on a lot of people in a small area without an escape route, can cause serious harm or death, and that was a situation with 400 people on this bridge.
You've asked for a temporary restraining order. Would that tie their hands in using these kind of violent methods against the water protectors if you win it?
Well, if they would, yes. The idea would be to get an order that they cannot use these kind of weapons against peaceful protesters or nonviolent protesters. These protesters, the police were way behind barbed wire and barricades. They weren't threatened in any way. So, yes, we're saying that to use these kind of crowd control mechanisms, but to shoot them and mass amounts of tear gas also and tear gas canister. And we're even told that these concussion grenades, they have a 7-second time fuse. And so they're supposed to throw them so that they end up on the ground. But we're even told that in some cases they were waiting 5 seconds and then throwing it into a crowd, which, of course, could have it explode anywhere on people's bodies or heads. And that's what we think happened with regard to this one woman who had her arm injured.
And
so we want to stop that. And particularly, it's interesting, the sheriff, 2 days earlier, had put out a warning. People need to leave camp, and they should be warned about hypothermia. And here are the danger signs, and here's it can be deadly, it's dangerous. So he's well aware of that. And then 2 days later, when people are peacefully protesting on a bridge or trying to clear the bridge of these two trucks that were there, they bring out water cannons and spray people intermittently for several hours from like 8 o'clock at night to 2 in the morning.
And such use of so-called less lethal weapons is clear violation of international norms because it's so disproportionate to
exactly.
the to force.
That they're not entitled to use excessive and unreasonable force, certainly on peaceful demonstrators. And even if one or two demonstrators throws a rock or something, that does not allow them to unleash this tremendous response. In this case, I'm not sure anything was done violently other than an attempt to pull one of these trucks off the bridge so that people would have access to Bismarck, to the emergency services. Interestingly enough, this bridge also blocks people from going up to the site where DAPL has drilled across the highway and now all the way up to the Missouri River.
Jeff, you mentioned that the veterans might be converging from across the country. I read reports that as many as 2,000 might come to serve as so-called human shields for the protesters.
Well, I think that's what they're coming up there for. They are veterans, and people are actually putting together all kinds of plywood shields just to shield themselves from some of these rubber bullets. And then they have these bean bags filled with lead pellets and all kinds of it. Sort of like they're trying out all these supposedly crowd control mechanisms. But when there a lot of people are in a small area, massive amount of tear gas and water and rubber bullets can be lethal or they can cause serious bodily harm. And you're right, they are forbidden under much of international law. And we think they're forbidden under excessive force, that the force should be proportionate.
Right.
In none of these cases was any life threatened by the protesters. So, in other words, it wasn't like the police were about to be harmed or anyone was about to be harmed. So we think it was excessive, it was unreasonable, it was dangerous force. And we're suing the sheriff and the police chief, sheriff of Morton County, the police chief of Mandan, and another county, Stetson County, that brought this water cannon in.
Jeff, I want to ask our listeners to get a pen or a pencil because I'm soon going to give them the phone number of both the White House and the Army Corps of Engineers. And I wanted to ask you what your suspicion is. Mine is that the governor of the state of North Dakota isn't doing this unilaterally, and that when he decides to issue ultimatums to the protesters, they're checking with the White House. This seems to me to be something that's coordinated the way it was with the closing down of Occupy Wall Street. And I wondered, what do you think the role of the Obama White House has been in this? And what could Obama do if he really wanted to protect the water protectors?
Well, I think you're right. There's really clear communication going on. I think in one sense, neither the federal government and maybe even not the state government want a real massacre to occur, which is threatened if they come in with this force and there are thousands of people resisting. So both would like to threaten the groups in a way that gets them to leave. That has not turned out to be successful. Obama could do a couple of things very easily. The main thing he could do is just say, we're denying you a permit to go under the Missouri River. And even if he did it, now the problem is, of course, Trump is going to take over. But if he put a process in that would take 6 or 9 months, this pipeline is very precarious financially right now. And the people who've agreed to send their oil through the pipeline, they have a right to get out of their contract starting in January. So if they do, and because oil prices are so much lower, this DAPL could really fall through because there's no need for it, and nobody's going to pay them to transfer their oil. So if Obama, first he could deny the permit completely to go under the Missouri. Two, he could start a process that would take so long that probably the financial people would call in their loans, and it wouldn't be practical. And I'm sure he could send a signal. He could say, I'm not going to allow. These are the civil rights of protesters. Somebody, Bill McKibben had an interesting article that, I know it was late, but the federal government did send monitors and lawyers and justice people into the South to integrate. And if necessary, Obama administration could do that here. So I think there are quite a lot of things he could do, and he has not given any signal about anything. He's really stood on the sidelines. I'm not sure what he's waiting for. He gives mixed signals. He orders that the pipeline not proceed within 20 miles of the Missouri and not go under the Missouri, and yet they've built the pipeline right up there. They've got the drilling equipment. Rumors are they may already be drilling under the Missouri, and Obama's done nothing to enforce the request by the Army Corps of Engineers, Department of Energy, to not do it. So they could enforce their current request and say this current route is a threat to sacred sites, is a threat to protection of wildlife. It goes right under this lake, which is the drinking water for the tribe, and of course the Missouri River. And it seems like they could do a lot of things and take a strong stand. Obama at one point said this pipeline needs to be rerouted. Well, of course, we would like the pipeline not routed at all, but at least to take it away from the threat to the sacred lands and the treaty territory of the Sioux.
If our listeners are interested in calling the president or the Army Corps of Engineers, the White House number is 202-456-1111 and the Army Corps of Engineers 202-761-0011. That's something you can do in a couple of minutes that will make a difference.
Give the number again, Heidi.
White House 202-456-1111 and the Army Corps of Engineers 202-761-0011.
Heidi and I are very grateful for your good work and for your coming on Law and Disorder and educating our audience about what the score is. And we look forward to talking to you very soon.
Well, I hope so. And people can go to our Facebook page, Water Protectors Legal Collective, for an update on the legal struggle. There are 500 cases that we're going to have to deal with, so we could certainly use support for our legal efforts. We're basically pro bono attorneys from out of state working with in-state attorneys and trying to get as much representation as we can for the water protectors.
And you've been real troopers, Jeff. Thank you all so much.
And thank you for publicizing and getting the word out, because there is a blackout.
And not just publicizing, we sent in our donations to the Water Protectors Legal Defense, and we'll keep it up, and we'll speak with you very soon. Thanks, Jeff Haas.
Thank you all so much for what you're doing. You keep it up. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.